members could communicate papers from non-members, and which would be published without refereeing. So Franz Kahn worked on the time scale for gaseous nebulae, and we had produced a little paper, and he Struve looked at it and said, "Oh, it is very interesting, and it should be published as quickly as possible." Abjay, in those days, it took a long time to appear. So he said, "I will communicate it to the National Academy," and it was published in record time, a week or 2 weeks or whatever time to get it printed. But no astronomer looks at National Academy proceedings.
Well, they did way back. I mean, Hubble published a lot of stuff in the 30s.
Yes, yes, in those days it did. But I have never seen, or hardly ever seen, a reference to that paper by Franz Kahn and myself, even though that was the first paper in which the expansion time scale of H2 regions was estimated as being as short as 10,000 years. And it mentioned, we computed and gave in the paper that the lifetime of Orion Nebula at that time could not have been much more than about 10,000 years, it would all disappear. We had suggested that, but hardly anyone knows about that.
Tell us about Struve. What was he like? Did you interact with him much?
Posse?
No, Struve.
Struve, yes. I mean, interacted in the sense that every day, morning coffee time and afternoon coffee time, he came from his office, pulled out everyone who was in their offices, and we went down to the cafeteria for coffee. And he used to talk about all sorts of things. I mean, in addition to science, as well as his interactions with astronomers worldwide. And it was very well, I mean, he was very perceptive. And you mentioned some topic like that, he immediately could visualize the implications of what you're saying from his very broad knowledge, because he had been writing this monthly article in Sky and Telescope for 25, 30 years or something like that. And you know the way he used to write those articles? He will sit there, Miss Ness will come and sit there with the shorthand. I mean, her, she was a good stenographer. She will note down, I mean, it was dictated to her, just straight like that, with no draft and all that. And she typed it up, and out it went to Sky and Telescope. It was amazing.
Those were well known, required reading.
Required reading for everybody on every area of astronomy. He would do that. He was amazing, but he was very friendly with the astronomers. And because he was there, he brought four short visits, a lot of astronomers from around the world to Green Bank.
For example?
Let me see. The ones who came specifically because of Struve. I mean, the European astronomers who came there.
George Field?
Yes.
He wasn't a big shot then.
No, Biermann.
Uh-huh.
He spent actually a week Ort and I mean people of his generation
right.
by and large, not the younger ones. Younger ones came on their own.
Like field? Like field.
Yes.
But what is about his interaction with NRAO activities and as director?
As a director, he, I don't think with the general staff there was very much interaction, because he was, even though he was very communicative, but he gave the appearance of being very serious type of person, but he can laugh. When the occasion arose, he had a very good laugh. But generally speaking, he was serious, and he didn't want to deviate too much from what the discussion was about scientifically, out of the range. He didn't talk too much about personalities. There was no social interaction.
Yeah. No, I meant his role as director of NRAO. Now he didn't.
Well, he felt a little bit out of step, in the sense that among the radio astronomical community and the AUI, there were not many people who knew him. So his advice on matters, because he was not, he has no engineering background as such, even though he was very much involved in McDonald Observatory in Texas, I mean setting up Observatory in Texas. He had practical experience with telescopes, but radio astronomy, he was, not only did he have any experience directly with instrumentation, he did not know many of the people involved, particularly in East Coast. There was, you know, that very clear distinction between the East mm-hmm. Coast people and the West Coast people.
At that time, the 140-foot construction was still in AUI's hands, right?
Yes.
So
he felt very frustrated. Yeah. He felt very frustrated that he didn't know exactly how to handle that complex set of issues which arose in the 140-foot. Where exactly was the difficulty in completing the project and the technical issues involved? I mean, many others did not understand either.
Yeah, that's an understatement. We just heard yesterday that there's still problems.
Yeah. And when he went for the AUA board meetings, Brookhaven, the people who were there, they didn't know him at all. And so they didn't pay much attention to what he was frustrated about. And some of those people, being the physicists, they also did not really appreciate that there was a need for direction. Of course, there were people like Purcell, who knew what was going on, but they were all involved, busy people.
But they should have known from the Brookhaven experience. I mean, in a way, it was very similar.
Yes, but activity. They were. I don't think many of them had time to pay attention to. They were all involved and busy people. I mean. All the senior people who used to come for the board meeting, they just did not have the time to discuss these issues.
No, there were too many issues at Brookhaven, I guess.
Yeah, Brookhaven. And you recall that that big hole in the ground in the radar in West Virginia that
Naval Research Lab.
Sugar Grove?
Sugar Grove. Well, Purcell was skating in his report as to the foolishness of that whole project. And so it did not go well with the political administration, I mean, in the Defense Department.
Sorry, what then?
The Sugar Grove, that the whole concept.
Right.
He was very scathing remarks about it.
Purcell.
Purcell, from Purcell. I don't know whether he even wrote a letter or something about it.
And you think that
that diver
carried over to NRA, to the radio?
Yes, fire. Yes.
But what about the actual operation? Because you came in 58? When did you come to, after Pennsylvania, when you came to NRA?
The first time I came, it was in 59 somewhere.
59. And so Struve was the director for roughly 2 years after you came. So
yeah.
But what I was asking was more of his role as director. Organizing things, observing.
He did not take part. I mean, obviously he had no scientific programs of interest to him, which was to be done.
So what did he do as director, other than writing scientific American articles?
That is a very good question. He did not play a role in developing NREO as a radio astronomical observatory, because except for the prestige of a man like him being the director, he was not involved in the science. And the only publicity NREO got during that short period was, you know what.
I do, but go on, because you were involved.
Yeah. Well, but he was very critical about it, in the sense that as a scientific enterprise, he felt that it is something which need to be done at some time. I mean, that is valid science, in the sense that the questions arising out of that, they were all very valid questions. But he did not have the technical knowledge like people like Purcell or Phil Morrison, others, of how it could be accomplished. And when it came to managing the personnel, there was a little problem, in the sense that NREO was probably getting a little unwarranted publicity. What could be discussed scientifically and pursued scientifically in an orderly way, it got out of hand. Even though he should have known that with a topic like that, the public interest would be there. Because the first day we were to start observing, I tuned the parametric amplifier. It was very unstable parametric amplifier at the focal box, and I tuned it and just got it stable, just barely stable. And then it was cold in the focus box. I got down from there and came into the building. Then I said, well, I had to go to the residence hall. And when I was reaching the residence hall, there was a reporter there. And he said, oh, you must be all excited about this experiment. So I can see the excitement in your steps. I told him, no, it's cold. I'm shivering from that cold there. It is not the excitement of the saints. But then I asked him who he was. He was a reporter for a science, a small magazine.
Science News? Or
Science News, Science News. And I asked him, how did you know we were going to start the experiments today? He said, I won't tell you. I knew immediately how he got in, because only three people knew who we are going to start observing that day. Frank, Omar Boyer, and myself. We are the only three who knew at around what time we hoped to start the coordinates and all that. And Omar certainly didn't talk to anybody, and I didn't talk to anybody. So from that time onwards, sort of on the wrong foot with regard to the project, in the sense that what should be emphasized, what should not be. Of course, my interest was not in the... it was for the magnetic field.
Right.
And very soon after I started that, I realized that the stability of the system was not enough to get any definitive answer.
Just to clarify, Coach, this was a receiver that either you built or you had built for the Zeeman?
Yes.
Test,
yes. And not only that, as you know, I was at the University of Pennsylvania at that time.
Right. Oh, you were still at Pennsylvania.
I was still at the Pennsylvania, and as I said earlier, there was supposed to be collaboration with the universities
right.
to build there and bring stuff. So we talked about it at Greenbank once, about the Zeeman experiment, all that, and what is needed, all receivers and antenna feed. At that time, we did not have a feed necessary for the polarization measurement. So I went back to Pennsylvania. I called up Henry Jessick. Henry Jessick was the designer of the feed for the 85 foot, and he would also been the designer of the field at the Harvard, 24 foot. So I called Henry Jessick and asked, this type of feed we will require, and how much would it cost? He sort of, off the cuff, he gave an answer, $8,000. Well, that's a some amount of money, but not a big deal. So I said, I haven't gotten any money. I've been at Penn just a few months. So I said, I'll try to find out where some money can be obtained. So the only person I knew was Gerhard Mikschajka, who was the science in charge of Cambridge Air Force Research Center. He had been a lecturer at Harvard. He was a German who was given special preferential visas to migrate to U.S. after the war. And he had been in the German Air Force and all that. But he was an astronomer. And his name was known to astronomers. High-velocity stars. Not high-velocity stars.
Runaway stars?
Globular clusters. Let me see exactly. He had published papers in pre-war days, apparently, on some high-velocity stars or the asymmetry in the velocity distribution. I forget now the exact detail. So his name was known, and he was hired by Harvard Observatory as a refugee scientist. He was a lecturer. So I knew him at Harvard in my student days, even though he was senior to me. So he was with Air Force. So I called him and said, Gert, I need $8,000. He was in charge of giving grants to the astronomers. I said, it just so happens that I have a balance in my this year's budget of $8,000. You can have it, but be quick and write a quick proposal and send it to me. I will grant it. And he did. As soon as I got his approval, I called up Henry Jessic and said, go ahead and design the feed. I'll get you the money. Mishaka has promised me that. So I went to the vice president of Penn, in charge of research, that branch of the administration. And I told him that we are getting this grant. I was getting this grant for $8,000, but that is exact amount, $8,000. There is no provision for any charges by the university. So is it possible that the check will come and check will go out? There is no administration involved, no overhead. He said, well, as an exception, we will do it. He did that. So I got the check from the whoever it was, the check, and I gave it to him, and he gave it to Andrew Jessic. And that was how the feed was built.
And what about the rest of the receiver?
The rest of the receiver was from NRAO.
It was, okay.
Within NRAO. It was a very simple type of...
Parametric amplifier.
Parametric amplifier. But the basic design, because it's basically a line receiver, it was similar. If I remember correctly, it was the same design of receiver, except for the local oscillator, as the Harvard one.
Okay. But it was built for your Zeeman experiment.
Yes, yes, yes. Because in the discussions for the OSMA, it was said it has to be a narrow band receiver.
Right.
And it has to be scannable. And so ideal one for 21 centimeter work also. So it was built specifically for that. But you had to do it manually. I mean, there was no scanning mechanism for it.
Wasn't there interest in, general interest in H1 work?
Yes, but it was going to take time. Doc Ewen was going to build a super duper line receiver, which never panned out. The whole thing was dropped. He was to build a very fancy multi-channel, 200 channels or something like that. You know, Doc had always these huge ideas. And he would have done it, but it would have cost a lot of money by the time he built it, but it never worked. And we couldn't wait.
Right, okay.
Oh, yes, there was certainly plans for a good line receiver, but it never worked out. And then it was clear, the parametric amplifier, you must have heard the story about the parametric amplifier. That was Doc Ewen arranged for that from, what was that company? It's a Boston company who built the parametric amplifier, and it was transported to here. Art Robichaud?
It was later, yeah.
Yeah. But not Art Robichaud, but who was the...
Sure, it was, wasn't Airborne Instruments, AIL.
Yeah, AIL, yes.
Long Island, I was in Long Island.
Yes, AIL built that.
Yeah, I know the guy's name.
I forget the name too.
I don't know, AIL is right, but I can't get the guy's name.
It was Art something too.
Not Art Robichaud.
No.
But anyway, it was an experimental parametric amplifier. And you know, that whole technology died.
Yes.
It just was so unstable. You couldn't get it to amplify anything.
Well, it amplified, but it also...
Very unstable.
But you said that Struve was critical about the
critical,
publicity, but he
privately.
Privately critical.
Privately critical, in the sense that I don't think he expressed very widely that NRA was getting the bad publicity for a good, valid concept and experiment which we will have to do someday. And questions which are being asked and being worked on by various people, they're all valid things. But we are promising something to the public which just cannot be. We are not anywhere to give an answer to those questions.
And he did give this talk at MIT.
Yes, but in the talk, you'll see, he didn't talk about, he talked about the whole concept and saying that we are starting the project at a place like that. He wanted some publicity, but not the type of publicity. The only thing I got out of that was I was able to get in touch with my uncle of mine in Singapore, because in the July 1960 issue of Reader's Digest, there was a copy of an article which had appeared earlier in Newsweek, or an article about Osma, in which my name was mentioned. So my uncle, who was a doctor in Singapore, he happened to see that, and he wrote a card to me, said, "T.K. Menon, Project Osma, West Virginia." That was the address, and it was delivered.
We could get mail just addressed to you in Green. Person's name in Greenbank.
No, Project Osma, Greenbank.
Oh, Project Osma. Okay.
Yeah, Project Osma.
Well, anything addressed to Greenbank would.
There are two things, details about what you said that I would ask you about. One, it was always my view that Struve, with his prestige and reputation, by endorsing the scientific construct, gave enough shelter that the project could be done, that the board of AOI and all that would say, okay, it's good. I don't know whether it could have gone without some authority figure like Struve saying it wasn't Mickey Mouse science, it was real science.
No, I think his concern was not that it was not real science or it needed need of support, because it was not, as it was envisaged at that time, it was not a big expensive project.
Just a few days,
or even the instruments were not being thought out as being very expensive and things like that. So in that sense, purely internal discussion would have obtained as much support for that program as any outside expectations that NRA is doing something fantastic and need all the support from the outside community, either scientific or public in general.
What was shelter from ridicule?
Shelter from ridicule, I don't think. Struve, in his talk, he gave the basic valid argument. So, after that, there was no public, what they think, it's difficult to question. But in the scientific community, I don't think there was any ridicule in that sense. I mean, the question, the valid questions of the details of those calculations and all that. They were valid questions.
But once the Kekkonen and Morrison paper was published, I think that gave it credibility.
Yeah.
And that was before they actually did the observation.
Yes, yes.
But the planning for OSMO was first. I mean, I think that's not
widely
recognized, but nothing was published.
I'm thinking in the latter day, what would be called the Golden Fleece Award. You wanted to avoid that.
Yeah, I agree. I agree what you were saying.
The other question was the security, because I was there as a student when this was being done. I wasn't part of it. In fact, I was excluded from it, and I resented losing telescope time to this when it could be working on my thesis. But I do remember going to a briefing for the telescope operators that Frank held, in which he emphasized the importance that there be no leaks. No, do you remember a briefing like that?
Yes, yes. That was all on this, at one level, that was to be emphasized. But somehow the leak did happen.
Yes.
If there were any leaks, it had to come from Frank.
Yes.
I mean, as I said, there were only three people who knew.
So, getting back to the more general operation of NRAO, if it wasn't Struve that was guiding things, who was giving the...
Well, I think, in a quiet way, Dave got everyone else to focus on their own scientific interests and encourage them to go along the hard science which needed to be done. And I think all the others who are there, they were working on solid science with the facilities available, but it was still a little difficult to imagine the type of facilities which could be built up and the time scale involved, so that it's one thing to think of a project and then estimate how long will it take to get the hardware
right,
and all that going. That there was no way of making hard estimates of that.
So who was overseeing those activities of what instrumentation to build, what new telescopes might be built?
Well,
was it Dave or I mean, Finley?
Finley, I mean, I don't know whether one can pinpoint any particular individual. It usually came up, we knew we need one initial starting dish, I mean, 85-1. I mean, let's get it done, and a basic receiver, a continuum receiver. And obviously, since the dish surface is good for centimeter wavelengths, let's start to work. And there were enough projects being proposed both from inside NRAO as well as from outside that it is purely a question of programming to get the...
So where did the initiative for 85-1 come from? Or was it just the group as a whole?
With the group as a whole, that we have to have a first telescope and not wait for the 600-foot...
140.
No. 600 foot was the
right.
First thing being talked about in the original plans and all that.
But at this time, the 140 foot was under construction.
Yes, yes. Well, that everyone had great expectation that when it is ready, all the people at that time, they have programs to go on that. But the time scale was...
Do you understand what if any relation there was between this NRAO for 600 foot and the Sugar Grove. I mean, it can't be a coincidence that they're the same size. Was the thought that one would just take the Sugar Grove design and rebuild it? And why was that necessary if you already had one 600 foot?
But I don't think any astronomers had any input to those discussions.
So where did it come from, you think?
I think it was Lloyd Berkner's harebrained.
Or Hagen? Hagen was, of course,
I don't know. But the radio astronomers associated with the initial ideas for NRAO and all that, I don't think any of them put in the idea of a 600 foot.
Well, Hagen certainly promoted it.
No.
And
the IRE, radio astronomy issue, had a plan for the telescopes.
Yeah, but my question was.
I know what your question was.
Which came first?
Well, I think that the Sugar Grove did, and I think there was never any hint of expectation of any kind that Sugar Grove telescope would ever do astronomy.
Yeah.
Until they decided that it was a fiasco and they couldn't build it, then it became a radio telescope. And that's what the coach was saying, that cast dispersions at NRAO, because from the outside, they all look the same.
Is that right?
Yeah. And fortunately, in the public view, it didn't stay very long. It died. I mean, hardly anyone alive now even knows about Sugar Grove. So it was a very short time scale, and since there was some secrecy associated with it, everyone outside the scientific community who became aware of it said, oh, it must be some secret project.
And there was?
It was. And until, I don't know whether Purcell published it in a note somewhere, because one of the justifications for the 600 foot was to listen to the Russian transmissions. And he showed that a satellite could do it so much more cheaply.
Well, I think that was the death of part of the death of Sugar Grove, the technical and cost problems. Satellites came along, whereas I think
they were not there when
it was conceived. Yeah.
Yeah, it had an effect on NRAO, Sugar Grove, and in the public mind there was that confusion of the two.
I believe the National Radio Quiet Zone, in fact, is centered on Sugar Grove, not Greenbelt.
Yes.
And so, there was connections and involvement. Mm-hmm. Well, let's get back to NRAO. Yesterday you told me, I think, that you had been present at this meeting at Hot Springs, I think, where they talked about getting the land.
Not getting the land, but I think the engineering corps,
right,
corps of engineers, already obtained the land, and it has to be transferred to AUI.
The land is always federal land, wasn't it?
No. It was probably.
Not. I mean, after NRAO took over. It doesn't belong to AUI now.
Well,
it belongs to the federal government.
Ted is really bitter about that. AUI obtained, according to Ted, I don't know this.
Yep.
And he's telling the last time or second last time we had lunch, where we go to have lunch with Ted every once in a while. AUI had obtained options on all but one or two of the pieces.
Right.
There was little or no hostility.
Right.
The prices were fair in the views of the displaced persons, and they were selling willingly in the sense there wasn't any condemnation. At some point in the process, AUI had gotten the head of the NSF on this, but at some point in the process, the NSF decided that the Corps of Engineers had to do it by eminent domain. And that's when the wheels came off. The Corps of Engineers went ahead and got the land. That land's never been turned over to AUI.
No.
Right? It's, you know, part of the federal land.
Yeah, it's still federal land.
I see.
But Dave, my understanding, that talk to my son-in-law who deals in this stuff. The options, there was no fixed price. The options mean that AUI had the right to obtain the land at whatever price it was going to be sold for.
I guess that's correct,
right.
Yes.
And it's my theory that, and this was done, AUI, Berkner got these options prior to AUI having the contract for NRAO.
I don't know that, but you could be right.
And I believe he did this to get AUI, you know, one up on the NSF as far as who would get the contract, because there were other competitors.
Okay.
And the NSF saw this and...
I see.
And put... Is it, I mean, this is my own reasoning. I haven't ever seen this.
No.
You know, just took it over by the right of eminent domain, to even the playing field.
Mm-hmm. That's quite reasonable.
Okay, but anyway, tell us about the meeting you were at.
Well, 57, we had the meeting. We were all invited to come in Hot Springs, in the hotel there.
Homestead?
I think so.
Yeah,
it
must have been.
It must have been. The meeting there.
Remind me, where were we, just to keep track, where were you coming from then?
I'm from Harvard.
You were still at Harvard.
Okay. I was at Harvard at that time. And then there was a function in Green Bank. We came in buses from Hot Springs, and some sort of speech making and all that. It was supposed to be, I mean, my recollection is that AUI was taking over the land from the Corps of Engineers. I mean, that was supposed to be the reason for that meeting and that function. And that was all. I mean, there was no science or anything connected with it. That function, there was some a few speeches being made. I don't know who was there from NSF at that meeting. I know Charles Dunbar, the legal AUI person, he was running around carrying papers and in the speech making and all that.
I think my mother had already left the NSF by then.
Yeah.
So she wasn't at that meeting, probably. You might have remembered if she was.
I think, if I recall correctly, the NSF representative, not Jeff Keller.
That was the name I was trying to come up. I was going to say the guy who did the quantum levels and transition, and that's Keller.
Jeff Keller, yeah.
Keller.
You thinking of Oster? You thinking of Oster?
No, he lost her.
Yeah, that's why.
Keller did Keller Meyer on tables of
atomic
transition.
I
yeah. And he, I think, immediately succeeded my mother. So it's conceivable it was he that was there.
No,
it would have been appropriate.
I have a feeling when in connection with that, Jeff Keller, it was, he must have taken over. What year would have been it when your mother stepped down?
I would have guessed about 1956 or so.
56, because I told you about this letter from the fellows of Harvard College for my appointment, how it was changed from 1 year to a 5-year term. I have heard, I don't know from whom it was, that Harvard wanted Tommy Gold to be the project director. But Jeff Keller said, no way. So they had to appoint, and I knew Jeff Keller, not very well, but I knew him casually. So it was Jeff Keller who said, it has to be the one who is running the project now.
Well, that would make the timing right for him or his associate to have been the one at this site.
The other person who was, who I think after Jeff Keller, who was it?
RPI? Fleischer?
No, no. No, this was much later. No, Fleischer probably was in between. But I'm thinking of another Dutchman. I forget now the name. I was able to get some money out of him for the Indian project from the NSF. In NSF is supposed to be entirely in those days for all the internal domestic purposes. But in that 1 year, this must have been in 62 or 63, much later, where they are listed the grants NSF had given to various states, various universities, and all that. At the very end of that, the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research, some $25,000 or something like that.
Of course, they gave money to the Mills Cross and the Parks Dish. So they were funding things.
But it was amazing that grants to all the various states and universities, but NSF was not supposed to get involved with foreign grants.
Well, Fleischer, I don't know that he has succeeded Keller directly, but I lived in the house that Fleischer lived in when he was in the summer in Greenville in 1960.
Yes, yes.
He was still at RPI then. So he moved to the NSF in 62 or 63.
Yeah, I knew Fleischer quite well because the first AAS meeting I attended was at RPI.
Well, this taking over from Corps of Engineers to AUI, it must have been just taking over the responsibility for developing the land.
Right.
Not legal takeover.
Right.
It was some sort of responsibility taking over. That was the only justification for that meeting.
Was Lloyd Berkner there?
I'm not sure. I don't think so. I don't know who all were there because.
Did you know him? Did you have any contact with Berkner?
Berkner, not really. Because the only thing amusing one I know of is one day after dinner at residence hall, walked along the main road back and forth, evening walk, and he was quizzing me about developments in astronomy, what was important, what is going on. I mean, it's a general discussion about astronomy, and after it was over, John Finley called me and said, you have coached him for his next talk, did you know that? Berkner was to give a talk somewhere, it seems, and he wanted to have the latest in astronomical news. And he said, you have given him all the news for his next talk. But I did not know him personally much, but casual, several times.
What were your impressions of?
Well, he was a bigger operator, all right. I mean, but for him, I would not have flown first class in U.S. Airlines. Did you know that? Before when the NRA was first established, all the scientific staff flew first class in the planes. When we flew for the meetings or anywhere, first class. Mm. Until I am told that that's the day we mentioned, one day he got down at Washington National from the first class, and the NSF director from economy class, and that's the end of that. And that would not have happened but for Buckner, because he wanted everyone in the scientific staff to fly first class.
I heard this story from Dave, but slightly with a different taint.
What?
Dave, I heard he told it several times, but he said that he was first class because, you know, he got a late ticket and it was full or something like that. He never said that.
No, I flew first class too.
That they went regularly.
Yeah,
Dave.
That certainly was the impression he should.
Yeah, and he told that story about having met the NSF people on the same plane. And,
yeah, but that's different in the
right
country's story as it was Berkner himself. So a little disconnect.
No. Otherwise, I would never have that. Never again did I fly. And those were the days when airlines served meals in real China and real.
What about Robbie? Did you have any contact with him?
Just casual conversation at the board meetings, not in any personal way, no. I knew he was the president of AUI, I think, when my tenure was discussed. Dave told me that he was the... So he came and asked who are... some letters he has to obtain, whether I could suggest some names. And I don't know who he finally wrote to.
Well, Robbie asked you?
No.
Oh,
Dave asked me because Dave had to
submit
the papers. So, and then he mentioned Robbie is very tough at looking at these. So we have to get it from the right people whom Robbie is likely to have come across, not from some unknown, somebody from India or something like that.
You coexisted with Groat Reaver in Greenbank for a while.
Oh, yeah. No, when we were fellow bachelors in Hill House, we interacted a great deal, and he made me dig those bean holes for his beans. We were very, very friendly. I mean, he, of course, had his strong views. But he thought he could be more frank with me than people like John Finley or who were the others.
Who was also living there.
Yes.
More frank about what?
I mean, in general, his opinion about others.
Was he critical about NRAL then? He certainly was in later years.
Well, he was critical of big science in general.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
So in that sense, not Project Samsung. After all, he was using the facilities of NRAL. So no. He, in general, he did not believe in big science, even though he realized as in his days what he built would have been considered big science. I often reminded him of that. Your telescope in your early years must have been big science, not in terms of money, but in terms of the facilities.
Were you there during the meeting with Russia?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. That was 61, isn't it? Yeah.
61,
yeah.
61.
Yeah. That was a real, for them, much more than for us.
Was that something that was initiated by Struve through his contacts? Or where did that come about? How did that come about?
I'm trying to recall who initiated that. I think by that time, there was, at least among the astronomical community, for closer interaction with the Russian astronomers. And I'm sure Struve played a role in that. And and his influence in the National Academy, it was through the National Academy that whole thing came. And of course, the details of the things were all handled by the National Academy and the Soviet Academy of Sciences. And we did not know until the last minute who will be members. And the fiasco part of it was the translator which the Academy sent for the meeting. That lady had no scientific background whatsoever. For every word from Russian to English or English to Russian, she did not know how to translate. And it turned out that even though she was in the listing translator for the National Academy, she was really a CIA operator.
Oh.
I found that out by accident. I got to the, her name was Edmondson. So talking to her in the cafeteria, it turned out that her previous experience overseas was she worked in the U.S. IS, as it is called, U.S. Information Service, in my home state in India, which was a communist state. She was working there for 3 or 4 years. I didn't think National Academy would send somebody from their staff to Kerala, India. So then we still had at Green Bank that old telephone exchange.
Yes, sure.
And so any calls coming from outside or going out had to be plugged in there. And there were only a few of us who knew how to do it. And we all knew which rooms everyone was staying, including this lady. And whenever we wanted to call, whoever wanted to call, so I used to take them to the lab and plug in. And but it was always from about 11 o'clock or 11:30, her room was plugged out outside world, I don't know to where, but for an hour, hour and a half, that her room was tied up with external calls. So obviously she was reporting what all happened, nothing much was happening. So she must be making up stories.
Hey, one more topic, Coach Yu. The recombination line work, Metzger and Hoglan. So they found the recombination lines 140 foot, soon after went into operation. But they did some experiments the year before on 85-1.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know much about that? Or
I'm trying to recall exactly what. I have not given much thought to that.
Okay.
What exactly happened, because there was discussion about it. How much was involved, because I got into the recombination thing only later on with Howard, Payne. Engineer at that time.
John Payne?
John Payne. John Payne and I published papers, but that was later.
Yeah.
That was later. So at the time, all I know is the what Hoagland and in the publication,
science.
In science, trying to recall, there was some. He had sent it to Nature first, isn't it? Oh, now that's coming back. It was 67, is it?
No, it's 65, I think.
65.
Soon after I got there, when the telescope went into operation.
Yeah, I had sent papers, I think it was in 65 maybe. There was one of my papers on the curvature, following, I think, your paper. From the low frequency turnover, how to estimate the sizes of. Now, Peter and Oakland, they were preparing their paper, and the question was where to publish it. Now, Nature, of course, is the obvious one to send. I had sent my paper on this to Nature, and surprisingly, within less than a week, I got an acceptance. I mean, as fast as the mail could cross the Atlantic, I got the acceptance. And Peter had sent, they had sent the paper for publication soon after that. And they waited, and they waited. No reply came. And so he sent phoned or sent a telegram or whatever to Maddox, asking why the paper has not appeared. And the rumor is, and I had not seen the letter itself, Maddox wrote back saying, I do not, something to the effect, I do not any such inquiries from authors. Like that, why some paper is not being published. And so he returned the paper, and then they sent it to Science. That's one version I have heard. I don't know how much truth there is of what exactly Peter got back from Maddox.
Now, that was 140 foot material?
Yeah, 140 foot.
Okay, I think we're done, unless there's anything else.
No. Yeah.